So good afternoon. If you ever seen the movie Jaws, I had this clip, but I didn't stick it in. Guy's on the back of the boat chumming for the shark, and the first time they see the shark, it comes out of the water, and it's an order of magnitude bigger than everyone had imagined. And he walks up to the captain and says, "We're going to need a bigger boat." And I think that's most of us have seen that shark come out of the water and immediately realize we're not equipped for the task that we set out to accomplish. Now, I'm going to talk real generally today, and the idea was to maybe provoke some discussion or some ideas. So I don't have a lot of specifics in here at all, but here's the point. I'm trained as a biochemist physiologist. So now we're going from dozens of measurements that I can handle wonderfully to millions of measurements that make me fall asleep when I'm lucky and keep me awake at night when I'm not. What I want to talk about, new challenges requiring new tools and approaches, the scale that we need to address in our efforts. This is probably preaching to the choir. Some of the tools that we might include, the stuff we mess with is temperature, climate analysis, canopy, and leaf level gas exchanges, and then gene expression and metabolites, that sort of work. We're focused. And then finally, who should be driving instrumental approaches? As we go into the 21st century, it's to come up with 21st century approaches to the 21st century problems in agriculture. We've gone to a meter stick with a barcode, and we can, we all look at that and go, certainly we're better than that. And we all know that, but it's hard. So the new challenges require new approaches. And we look in our region on the southern high plains of Texas, we're looking at a future where maintaining yields with diminished resources is replacing our old paradigm of increasing yields. So we're simply trying to hold on to what we've got as our resources go down. So trending, of course, big data. And of course, with automated data collection, everyone gets big data. You don't have to go very far to find that. As Paxton mentioned, high-throughput phenotyping. We barely even have low-throughput phenotyping, yet now we got breeders wanting high-throughput. Currently, these fields are largely driven by technology. They're heavy on engineering, and I think they may be a little light on biology. And, of course, my bias is as a biologist. That leads us to the issue. You know, if you don't know where you're going, any road is going to take you there. So we need to make sure we're taking the right roads. So many of our current tools are limited, conceptually or physically. We need to develop those approaches. New technologies are developing. If you do a Google search for high-tech agriculture, you get this thing in the corner, which is some sort of slick chicken coop on wheels. Probably we've gone beyond that. We have a little helicopter and a tractor and a lemon tech system and a bicycle wheel thing. And I assume that other thing is some sort of high-throughput outhouse that you can take to the field. I don't really want to think why we need that, but... So where we might be working and thinking, I tend to think in what I call the temporal spatial envelope that we're working within. And what we have is a temporal scale that goes from sub-hour, because we know important things go on in plants on a sub-hour basis, and the accumulated sub-hour activity of that plant over a period of more than 100 days or so is yield. So we've got to understand that time scale, sub-hour to hundreds of days. When we look at this stuff in a field system, we're looking from a sub-meter, maybe a single plant scale in the spatial scale, and then we need to scale that up to hundreds of hectares or 100 hectares to fit into management systems ultimately, or production systems. So if you look at that, you know, on the sub-hour, you're looking at your wristwatch. On the 100 days, you're working on a calendar scale. Single plants in the bottom corner when we're looking at sub-meter, but then you go up to small field plots, and then you end up going to pivots and thousands of pivots. So the scale goes up quite a bit. When we look at that, that temporal aspect, we're typically running about 10 to 15,000 measurements a season to capture that temporal scale. And that spectral, or the spatial scale, we got 10 to the 7th number of measurements. So we're talking orders and orders of magnitude. That's the challenge. Where we work conceptually, as I do, right, we have our germplasm. It's affected by an environment, and then the management is what we can do to work with that. I look at that as the germplasm is the biology. The environment modifies and limits that biology, and the management is what we use to direct that biology. Notice how I made biology a key component of everything we do. Engineering provides the tools to implement these things. Large collections and transgenics are available on the germplasm scale, and the environment can be modified to some extent, and it can certainly be measured and characterized. So planting dates and locations often involve the environment. Now, what are you going to measure in the biology? Assimilation, gene expression, metabolites, plant temperature, yield, all this across a range of germplasm in a range of environments. Be like Ginger Rogers. They said Ginger Rogers was the world's greatest dancer because she did everything that her partner did, except she had to do it backwards and in heels. And so that's where we are as the biologists. We've got to work over these very broad schemes. How do we measure them? We need to measure them comparatively, I believe. So the more comparisons we can make are the better. In that vein, then, we want to maximize the variation that occurs. We want to see lots of variation, not a small amount of variation. How do we increase the number of those comparisons? Spatial replication we can do, but that's always a problem, and we can talk about that a little bit. We can include more treatments to get more comparisons. Our standard is 4 water levels in our experiments. How can we increase the number of experiments or environments that are assessed? Well, you can do 30 years of the same experiment if you can get the funding for that, but that's kind of hard to do. You could use another hemisphere. We found that Australia is a pleasant place to do experiments. You can get twice as many experiments in a year, which means you have twice as many data points to analyze. It doesn't work out real well, but it's pleasant. You can also use sequential plantings, and we do that frequently to generate multiple environments in a year. My focus or bias is toward plant temperature as a real good biological tool. We know that plants are exposed to continuous thermal variation. Temperature affects all biochemical reactions. We can predict some of those effects in a very mechanistic manner. There's good theory for that. Canopy temperature is tightly coupled to plant water status and water deficits. We can measure it near continuously over growing seasons in a field, so that's very useful. And last thing, commercially available and is in use for on-farm management in a lot of places. So it's a technology that scales well. Here's how we sort of look at temperature stress in our fields. This is a series of 7 cotton plantings. First one was April 1st, and they go back in 2-week intervals. 4 water levels, dry land to fully irrigated from the left to the right. You can see some little sticky infrared thermometers out in the field. We do that. We generate 7 environments, 4 water levels, a 28 series matrix for a year. 3 years of that gives us a lot of data. That's what the canopy temperature data looks like when it comes in. Those are just time series of canopy temperature. 15 minutes, you can kind of see the different planting dates there as they're shifted in time. 4 water levels, and you can collect, most of those are 10,000 data points per. So we can collect a lot of temperature data. We do it with these cheap and plentiful IRTs. That was the idea, right? Simple, low maintenance, near continuous. Seasonal scale measurement, high density temporal data, wonderful. 15-minute measurements, no longer an exotic exercise, a physiologist could do it. Thousands of these are in use. Our cooperators in Australia have some devices. Lots of companies are building them. Pretty soon everyone will have one. Our goal was to deploy dozens in an experiment, and we rapidly reached the understanding that you need hundreds or thousands. So that becomes a clear limit. Here's why. Right, that individual smart crop sensor that we use, made by a company called SmartField, it gives us perfect resolution across the temporal scale. We covered the whole thing, sub-hour for hundreds of days, no problem at all. Problem is, we're down there in a very little portion of the spatial realm that we need to work in. So a whole lot of information in a little bit of space. How do we increase that? Well, you could put out a whole bunch of these devices, but it quickly comes to the point that even in a small breeding experiment, you need a couple thousand of the IRTs to adequately describe a breeding trend. That's a punch if you're going to do near continuous. If you do non-continuous, you put fewer IRTs, move them around in some algorithm, you mount them on IRTs, you put them on a robot, you make a drone. The problem with the non-continuous measurements, of course, is that we cannot measure everything at one time. You can't get everything measured at once in an environment. So you have to figure out how you're going to measure then, if it's going to be sporadic, when and how often. This is just a quick little example of some predicted assimilation rates being driven off of canopy temperature. The only thing to see there is that if you measure them, these are different water levels, that's the daily assimilation. You measure them at a certain time of the day, and they're all the same regardless of the water density. You measure them at another time of the day, and you may pick up the differences, but if you come back a little later in the afternoon, they're all back to where they were. So, you use a non-continuous measurement, you have to know something about it. Here's some thermal images we took this summer. Same story, that's the same field imaged on four different days at three different times of the day. And that's in Lubbock, where we think we have a pretty stable thermal environment. But you can see, depending on what that day is doing at 11 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon, you can get some different patterns. So you have to figure out if I'm going to make a 2 o'clock measurement or a 4 o'clock measurement or an 11 a.m. measurement, is that always going to capture what I want? And remember, we're going to be doing that from April through July. So where the sun is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Lubbock, Texas, changes quite a bit between April and July. So great detail within a small space with those. How do we expand the coverage of the envelope? We can do some thermal imaging, virtualization of IRT sensors. This is what we've toyed with. You take one image, it represents a point in time. You take 96 of those images, you start stacking them up into an array, and you can reach into any point in that array and pull out a time series of temperature. We had a CRADA with Smartfield and Bayer. They're going to talk about that. The key is when we do that, single field image covers the spatial range, 15,000 of those stacked on top of each other really covers the temporal range. And so we can increase the throughput and coverage by 3-4 orders of magnitude. So in a system like that, we can actually cover that entire spatial temporal envelope with a single device. Where are we doing time-wise, Patrick? Yeah. All right. So, now the other thing is, how do we look at the environment? Here's standard time series environmental data. Nice to look at, difficult to figure out. We got a whole lot of that. We're looking at we're using what we call a time surface approach, where we take that data, that time series data, and break it into what we call a time surface. We have the time of day on this little y-axis. We have the day of year on the x-axis, and then we can plot an environmental variable into that z-space. So we have a time surface that can represent an entire season or any portion of a season that you're interested in. We make these with a GIS system. Here's an example of a set of data for 10 environmental parameters. That's what the time series data looks like. Here's what it looks like when we put it into a time surface approach. The idea is to try to develop environmental phenotypes. Paxton wants to create the field of environomics, like we needed another omics. But the thing is, we put these into a GIS system. They're manipulable in 3D in real time. You can spin them around, get all sorts of different views. That's 3 years of what that data looks like. 3 years doesn't help. If you go to a decade of data, that's 10 years of time surface environmental variables. for Lubbock, Texas. Air temperature, dew points, relative humidity, and again, these are 365 days in that axis, 24-hour time period there. It produces a bunch of data like we needed more. You can flip those things around and you can begin to make some contour-type maps that show all kinds of interesting data. You know, the leftmost panel is the air temperature. You can clearly see at the top, 2011, the record hottest year in Lubbock, Texas. A kindergartner could pick that out. 2007 comes off as a really cool summer out of that decade. You can look at how the solar radiation affected that. The two panels over the side that are real hot at the top are soil temperature patterns. In our record hottest year, we actually saw monster soil temperature. The question is, how do you begin to look at that? We can get about 10 million observations on a single sheet that way. What do we do with plant data? So we've got all these temperature sequences, 3 years of that. So we've got three times that, canopy, weather temperature. We collected about 6,000 to 8,000 leaf samples for analysis that tag in with that data. Collecting the data is easy. Analyzing it's potentially difficult. The challenge we face is how do we bring all these levels of data together to make relevant comparisons. We think that temperature data presented as time surfaces or maybe in time sequences gives us a little bit of a treasure map where we can say when we have 6,000 samples collected over a season, what are the best points in time during that season to go dig for metabolite or gene expression data? So we think that maybe this gives us a seasonal scale view of what was going on phenotypically that we can dig down then and look for a genotypic or a metabolite phenotype. We can plot temperature. This is canopy temperature data plotted in the same format as time surfaces. It's air temperature and then canopy temperature running across for four different water levels, seven different planting dates. That's 2014 data. That's still coming in, I think. But this tool gives us maybe a way to look at a lot of data. That's what the canopy temperature data looks at, flipped down into it. Overarching, you can kind of see the coolness of the high irrigation, the hotness of the low, and then what goes on in between those. A good bit of information there, how you get into it. This is an example of sort of how we're using some of that data. We can use those seasonal environment and temperature comparisons to look at what the plant is doing temperature-wise relative to the environment that canopy temperature and BPDs. We can use that for irrigation management data. We can use temperature-driven metabolic modeling because we've got lots of fine-scale data. And then at the bottom is kind of how we're doing metabolite analysis based on those patterns as well. Here's where we're going, right? The Rosetta Stone provided the tool for translating hieroglyphs into an understandable language, a collinear text of Greek with a hieroglyph, right? The belief is that this kind of fine-scale data that we start pulling out using these phenotyping and instrument techniques tell us the stress story of the plant continuously over its life. The problem is it's in a canopy temperature language that we don't really understand. So what we need to do is align this text with the text that we know, which is physiology, which is things like root patterns, fiber quality, metabolites, gene expression, photosynthesis, so that when we get those things aligned, perhaps we reach a point where we begin to say, yeah, I know the metabolite history of the plant by looking at this. So we read the hieroglyph instead of having to read the lower level data that's much harder to get. So the idea is, can we create a Rosetta Stone for that approach? Who drives the approaches? Biology and relevance have to be included early in the system, right? Sensors are imaginable. Anything you can imagine an engineer can build, a bad idea is going to make a bad machine. You can give an engineer the stupidest idea in the world, and he or she will implement it perfectly and give you a perfectly worthless tool that does exactly what you told them to do. So, you got to think. One of the upsides, costs will decline over time. Now, here's the cartoon. I presented that cartoon to a company about 18 months ago, right? I reduced my idea into a goofy little cartoon that I didn't even put into a PowerPoint, right? I just drew it on paper and said, could we do this? And we'll see some work being done on that in a few minutes. The key is the biological insight is often the bottleneck in these things. So if you as a physiologist or a biologist can reduce your idea into a cartoon, most engineers can take your cartoon and make it into a machine. Here's who we're working with: Ogallala Aquifer Program, Cotton Inch, CRDC in Australia, ACRI and CSIRO, Bayer, Smartfield Agriculture, Geospatial Lab at Texas Tech University does all that. The advantage of the Australians is you can watch the sunset over the Indian Ocean, which is much prettier than watching the sunset over Lubbock, Texas. And that's it.